I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Michael Moss joins me again. The best-selling and award-winning journalist has just published another smash hit, one of the more anticipated books of the season, Hooked, Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. It looks at the decisions we make about what we eat, whether it's a healthy diet or not that we pursue, and how those decisions may not always be informed ones, as there's a lot that's not in our control. Mr. Moss looks at research as to addiction and why we're so addicted to food. And since we're hardwired for sugar, salt, and fat, it's no wonder that we're addicted to food and more than ever before. I'll get Michael to let us in on the research he's uncovered, as well as the tactics that big food manufacturers utilize to make processed food more portable, cheaper, tastier, and more addictive. Michael Moss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times. His previous book was the number one New York Times bestseller, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us, which he was on this program with in 2013. His website is at mossbooks.us, and his Twitter handle is at Michael Moss C. This new book is published in Canada by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Michael Moss. Mr. Moss, good morning.
Oh, good morning to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. One of the things that you talk about near the beginning of the book is how our conception of addiction has changed. And you write in the book that it's evolving, that one can view it on a spectrum. How surprised were you by that notion?
Well, totally surprised. I mean, if we had had this conversation 5 years ago and you suggested to me that Oreo cookies were as addictive as heroin, I would have, like, stopped, right? Because, I mean, come on, really? Get a grip. But I have to say that I've completely changed now, and there's a little doubt in my mind that a lot of these food products are more problematic than food. And one of the things that turned my mind was looking at the tobacco industry, which vehemently denied that smoking was addictive for decades and decades. And then in the year 2000, they turned and suddenly, kind of maybe for their own reasons, said, okay, you got us. Smoking is addictive. And that same year, the CEO of the company was asked, well, so what's your definition of addiction? He goes, addiction is a repetitive behavior that some people find difficult to quit. And that was such a moment for me in the reporting process for this book, because at the time, Philip Morris was also the largest manufacturer of processed food in North America, because it owned Kraft, General Foods, Nabisco. I later met with the general counsel of Philip Morris, who was one of those people who could smoke one cigarette a day, put his pack away, never think about it again. But he couldn't go near Philip Morris's other gigantic product, Oreo cookies, for fear of losing control and eating half the bag. So this kind of acknowledgement by the food industry itself, not to mention tobacco industry, that this is not a matter of willpower for so many people, but this is a matter of our products having some qualities that rob us of our free will. That was a huge moment of enlightenment for me as a journalist.
Processed food, I mean, has that changed in terms of how it's made and in terms of what's in it that say is triggering these addictive habits in us?
Yeah, oh man, has it changed. And look, I mean, at one point I met a scientist who was sort of saying to me, look, Michael, pushing back a little bit, saying, look, Michael, it's not so much that we're addicted to food. We by nature are drawn to eat and even to overeat. What's happened is that the companies have changed the nature of our food in the last 50 years, basically to make overeating an everyday thing. And let me give you some examples. So we by nature love food that's inexpensive, right? It means less energy expenditure on our part. Made much more sense for us to, you know, instead of chasing down an Impala for dinner, to grab an aardvark that's just sitting there.
Yeah.
So the food companies have chemical laboratories working for them whose main mission is to reduce, you know, the cost of, say, a box of frozen puff pastry breakfast tarts by 10 cents, knowing that we'll get really excited about that. So reducing the cost is one of the things that the industry has done for the food. Variety. We're drawn by instinct to food that's variable. It's why we were able to spread around the world and get excited about eating things like even whale blubber, right? And so that's why you walk into the grocery store, into the cereal aisle, and there's 200 kinds of sugary starch there. The companies know that we get excited about variety. And on, there's kind of four or five fundamental biological aspects to us that the companies now know how to tap into and exploit in changing the nature of their food. And again, bottom line, you know, to turn overeating, which used to be a good thing for us, into an everyday thing.
The idea that snacking, I guess, I mean, I was just thinking about snacking and how acceptable it is today than, say, 50 years ago.
Oh, my gosh, yes. So one of the hallmarks of addiction is speed. The faster substance can hit the brain, the more apt it is to lose control and act impulsively. And that's, again, that's true for cigarettes, alcohol, and drugs. But there's turns out there's nothing faster than food and its ability to hit the brain with these powerful forces.
Mm.
And so they did this experiment where they sat people down and said, tell us when you taste sugar and push a button. And so they put a little sugar on their tongue, and what happens when we eat is that that sugar doesn't go to the brain. It sends a signal via the taste buds and our own sort of system that gets the brain excited. And those people were pushing that button in less than 1 second compared to smoking, say, which can take 10 seconds to fully engage the brain. Alcohol and drugs were kind of somewhere in between. And so snacking became kind of the ultimate fast food, right? Because it's densely packed with calories. We can eat it really quickly without paying attention to it. And so it's incredibly effective in its ability to get kind of the stop part of the brain, the rational thinking part of the brain that says, wait a minute, Michael, I think you've had too much of that, to get that to go to sleep.
So as a result, our biology has changed. I mean, you know, hypertension, cancer, heart disease, obesity, diabetes. I mean, these are epidemic in throughout the world. A lot of people viewed obesity was a result of, say, a lack of willpower or discipline. What is your research over the years, and not just this book, but the previous book? What has that uncovered in terms of that notion, say?
I mean, I have to confess that I had some of those same feelings too. Like, look, you know, just don't eat so much. But again, kind of a lesson from the drug world. And look, we used to blame people for smoking, saying it was a matter of personal responsibility until we understood the power of these substances to rob us of our free will. These cravings come on so fast that nobody has a chance. I should say people don't have a chance to execute free will on the matter without lots of planning, right? And then the other sort of aspect of losing control here and kind of the addiction that I talked about happens on a spectrum. At one end are eating disorders, but at the other end are people who just kind of on a daily basis becoming overly dependent on these convenience food, processed foods, or eating just like a little bit too much. And day after day after day, you know, there's the weight gain or there's other ill health effects that kind of creep up on you. So that loss of control can happen, you know, at both ends of this spectrum when we're not paying attention.
Yeah. So this idea of food quality versus quantity, I mean, that's something that we all contend with. But as I was reading the book, I thought, you know, for some people, quality has to be sacrificed just out of circumstance. What's the remedy for them?
Oh, so that is the kind of most painful aspect of that. I mean, look, I've heard sociologists tell me that they've met mothers who will take their family to McDonald's for a family dinner, knowing that the food isn't so great for them, but appreciating the value of having that family get together. It's the only place that she can afford to take her family all together to go out for a meal, and the kids are interested in sort of going to that. So she's having to make that incredible decision in order to sort of get the benefit of that family get together and sacrificing the nutrition aspect of it. That's the hardest thing, is that the playing field is so unlevel for people who, by their economic circumstance, walk into the grocery store and are confronted with the choice of buying a basket of fresh blueberries or a 2-pound, 3-cheese, 4-meat frozen pizza that's going to feed their whole family. And certainly in the off-season, those things are going to cost the same. And that's just an inequity that is just kind of grossly behind the food trouble that we're in.
Yeah. But by the way, Michael, have our habits, as bad as they are, have they changed at all because of the pandemic, or have they been exacerbated by, say, our circumstances this past year or so?
Yeah, I don't mean to be the bearer of bad news, but we thought with the pandemic that at least we're going to get away from the vending machine at work, right? One of the more treacherous parts of the food system. But what happened is many people turned their kitchen cabinets into vending machines because we went shopping under the stress and strain of the moment. And the memory being so powerful when it comes to food had us buying stuff that we hadn't had since we were kids. I mean, I'm talking about junk food that we didn't even like, but yeah. The power of that memory and the idea of the comfort that food would provide us caused sales of chips and cookies and other snacks to soar, and they continued soaring during the pandemic. And so, yet again, it sort of illustrates how, and the food industry was doing certain things marketing-wise to exploit that vulnerability. And again, just shows how so much of our eating is emotionally driven and how really clever the industry is at punching those emotional buttons.
That's one of the, as I was telling you just as we started, one of the frustrating things about reading Hooked is how we don't think enough about what we eat. I'm wondering for you, over the years of writing this book and the previous one, have your habits changed at all? I know you live in a household with other people. I mean, do they take this greater awareness that you've gained? Do they take that to heart, say?
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to turn the tables on the food companies a bit and sort of take back things they stole for us, like convenience. Uh-huh. I'm starting to make my own spaghetti sauce, which isn't really all that hard. And even things like soda, we're trying to cut back on sugary drinks. And I have a couple of boys who love sugary drinks, but we've been able to shift to plain seltzer because, oddly enough, the bubbles, the effervescence in plain seltzer is kind of almost as exciting as the sugar. And what's really fascinating to me is that before the company started dumping sugar in soda, there was plain seltzer for hundreds of years. And people loved it and argued over different kinds of plain seltzer. So I love this idea of taking back things that the industry took from us and corrupted, if you will, for their own ends.
One of the things you talk about in the book that I found fascinating is a discussion about labels. Let's say you pick up something like a chocolate bar or a bag of chips even. It gives you the percentages for, say, a certain portion of, not the entire package. I mean, one piece of chocolate is different than, say, the six that are that are in the wrapping. What are the regulations on labeling and how? I mean, I guess there are none in terms of what a manufacturer can put on it.
Yeah, way back in the early 2000s, I wrote about it, salt, sugar, fat. In fact, my first book is how Kraft unilaterally tried to make some reforms in its products, and one of the things was that they decided they were going to put the full number of calories on packages of snacks where they knew so many of us would eat the whole bag and not just what somebody was calling a tiny serving, right? Uh-huh. That kind of went nowhere because of the viciousness in the food industry. They had to pull back on that sort of change for the better in their products. Slowly, the Food and Drug Administration has started to sort of catch up on that and nudge companies to report the full number of calories to make it a little clearer. But, you know, the whole nutrition facts box on these labels, you know, that clump of data sort of in the fine print, is not what I thought it was. I thought the government came up with that to help us. It turned out that was a creation and invention of the processed food industry as a way of sort of placating our growing fears what was in their products. And their idea was, if we just, like, throw a bunch of numbers and things on the package and it looks all great and stuff, people are going to think it's all great and stuff. But in fact, it's just numbers. It's what people call nutritionism, and it doesn't really have much to do with the essential question. Is this real food I'm eating here or something else?
Yeah, so there are no, say, legal obligations in terms of what a manufacturer can, should put on a package, right?
So they're obligated to sort of put, you know, the ingredients, right? Yeah. So they have to list the ingredients, and then, you know, these certain percentages that they put on the package. But in terms of, you know, information that truly kind of alerts us to what's in there, especially things like calories, it's still a nudging on the part of the government as to what they're doing. And an underappreciation of just how tiny the serving size is and how many of us will eat the whole package.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what then can a government do in your country and in my country in terms of say, improving that part of the packaging, if you will?
Well, certainly more disclosure. I mean, one could put on the front of the package kind of larger warnings. Some countries have tried like a red light, green light, yellow light strategy on the front of the package where you don't have to pay too much attention to get a sense of, like, where is this product in my day's eating habits, right? Is this a treat or is this something I can sort of be eating more of? I mean, that's one idea. One other thing government is doing is sort of the sugar tax, right? Putting a little bit of tax on sugary drinks as a nudge to sort of help people change their eating habits. Because look, I mean, we love money as much as we love cheap, convenient, tasty food. Mm-hmm. And those kinds of taxes seem to be happening. I mean, I get much more excited when I talk about things live or see people doing things like putting, you know, a garden in schools, not to feed the kids, but to get them excited about things like radishes. So they can come home and get their parents excited, and their parents can demand that their grocery store sells radishes, and then the store will demand that farmers grow radishes. So there's like a bunch of things that I think we can be doing, even without government involvement, to change how we value food. I think that's the bottom line here, is that for decades, we've allowed these giant food companies to tell us what's valuable in food. And in order to change that, I think now we have to decide for ourselves, what do I value in food? You know, is it taste, cheapness, convenience, or is it fuel and for my body and health and power and strength and family ritual, I should say, too.
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing that fascinated me about your book, was the pull of nostalgia and how powerful that is.
I mean, I walked into a factory making a research and development factory in Battle Creek, Michigan, not far from you all, and they had messed up a big vat of Pop-Tart material, and the smell wafted, the aroma, I should say, wafted across the factory floor. It took me back instantly to when I was 7 years old, a latchkey kid coming home from elementary school and popping one of those in the toaster. The power of smell and the power of memory, you know, these products never leave our head. They're there forever, just kind of waiting for a cue or a weakness or a vulnerability on our part to sort of jump on that go part of the brain and say, wow, let's get some more of that.
So we've talked about the legal obligations. What about ethical considerations as to who's ultimately responsible? I mean, that's the one thing that I come away from reading your book, that we may not be altogether the ones to blame for all of this. And so what responsibility do, say, big, international companies have in terms of what we've been eating?
So that's a tough one, and you might sort of guess that I think that they're responsible, but look, I don't see this as this evil empire that intentionally set out to make us ill from their products. But by the same time, I mean, these are companies doing what all companies want to do, which is make as much money as possible by selling as much product as they can. And I think that's important to understand going forward, too, because I don't think we can expect them to act like philanthropies. They're going to sell products that are good for us if we nudge them and help them do that. So I think it's good, both of us working together. People have to be willing to rehabituate themselves to better-for-you foods, or the companies aren't going to respond and make those foods. So it's kind of both of us needing to change our eating habits. And the amazing thing about eating habits, though, as a scientist said to me, you know, we love what we eat more than we eat what we love. And so what he meant was that, you know, you can train yourself to fall in love with broccoli or Brussels sprouts or celery. It's just kind of the repetition of that. and valuing what that kind of food does for you versus Oreos and Fritos and Twinkies is a total opportunity for us.
Now, your previous book was a smash. What was the reaction from these big companies as to what you wrote in this book? I mean, and I'm curious to know what you think their response will be to this one.
You know, I kind of think that privately they wish I hadn't been born. But,
sure.
But having been born, I think that they felt that it was hard-hitting but fair. And in fact, it wasn't long after Salt Sugar Fat was out that none other than Nestle, the largest company of all, and I thought I had tormented them as much as anybody in the book. They own the Hot Pocket brand.
Yeah.
I think I called that a poster child for mindless eating. They invited me to come to talk to their research and development people on the notion that they were trying to turn a corner and create better foods, and they needed me to tell them all the things that they'd been doing wrong by us in order to start doing right. So I think that even in these big companies, there are sort of cabals of insiders who want to change things and understand them. With Hooked, I think it may be a little harder for them to invite me in because I'm kind of going after the very essence of their foods and showing how they are even more hooked on making their foods really inexpensive, variable, exciting, tasty, all of these things. It's really hard for them to change and get out of that pattern.
What about this thing that we're seeing a lot of, not just in your country but mine, as the plant-based products? Certain fast food chains now have burgers that are made of this substance. Those are highly processed, aren't they?
Yeah, it's so interesting, and it kind of gets at this notion that food has a lot of different elements, and what we value in food has a lot of different elements. And I mean, one of the great reasons to sort of, you know, turn toward those meatless meat products is if you're concerned about animal welfare and possibly the climate, depending on sort of, you know, what the ingredients are. And
yeah,
I think there's still a debate over that. But yeah, on a nutritional basis, there may not be all that much difference between the meatless hamburger and the meat hamburger in terms of sort of pure nutrition. I mean, people care about workers and farmers who grow the crops and make the product. There's 10 different things that you might value in food and how that food was made. And what I'm seeing in these kind of tech foods that are coming along to, say, use, you know, dairy substitutes or meat substitutes or pea instead of soybean flour is that they may sort of address one aspect of those things, but not necessarily all of them. But hey, I mean, something's better than nothing, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting how companies themselves have seen that and are, I was going to say, preying on our desire to do something good and I guess selling us this stuff, right?
Yeah, but again, I mean, so again, sort of depending on your value, you know, eating and your values, what you care most about in food, that may be a good thing.
Yeah,
so turn to those products.
So 5 years ago, we would not have believed anybody who said that food is as addictive as heroin. Now we tend to buy that argument, or at least we'll listen. One wonders 5 years hence, where will we be? I mean, you're a journalist, not a clairvoyant, but you've done enough research over the years. I mean, do you have a sense of where we're headed?
Oh, boy. You know, I think it's, well, I would have said a couple of years ago that I was a little depressed, and I thought that ultimately, you know, the food companies have this ace card called, you know, food security. This is more and more as the population of the world grows.
Yeah.
I think they think that we're going to love them because they can deliver calories to us no matter what those calories are. I don't know. I mean, so many people are caring about what they're eating and trying to change their eating habits. We might well be in a better place 5 years from now when eating food that's good for you and convenient and tasty is also affordable and something you can make as a sort of a daily habit. I'm actually more optimistic than I was just a couple of years ago.
So Hooked is coming out to great acclaim, and people are buying it. salt, sugar, fat was a smash. Does it surprise you that people are interested in this subject, as bleak as sometimes it can be?
Well, it's food. Everybody cares about food. And look, I mean, you know, depending on what part of the spectrum you are in terms of being in trouble with food, I mean, we just passed, before the pandemic, 42% clinical obesity rate in this country, which, you know, by itself is sort of a definition of having lost some control over your eating habits, for many people anyway. And then at the other end, it's just like people feeling kind of the loss of the ritual of family cooked, you know, family meals with home cooked foods. And so I think so many people are caring and just kind of waking up to all that we've turned over to these big multinational corporations and the opportunity now of sort of taking that back. So I'm not at all surprised. I mean, everybody loves food in one way or another. We love to talk about it. And so I'm not at all surprised by the kind of huge reaction that the book is getting.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on this book. It's such a wonderful, wonderfully engaging read. I couldn't put it down. I had to read it almost in one go. So thanks for your time and all the best.
Oh, thank you so much for those kind words. And it's really great talking to you. You take care.
The website for more is at mossbooks.us. And, of course, Michael's Twitter is at MichaelMossC. The book is called Hooked: Food, Free Will, and How the Food Giants Exploit Our Addictions. It is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Michael Moss joined me on the line from New York City and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.